Discussion in the last class 2 weeks ago of the whole treatment of the healing vector and really the whole of Herman in that treatment. The material that we dealt with in the last class was primarily concerned with intellectual conversion and psychic conversion, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on in the review. The rest of it was not the rest of number two, I think, was fairly simple and straightforward, but I just want to review the material on intellectual and psychic conversion briefly. And we'll move into three and give a more extensive treatment of dreams, and I'll be able to do two short ones in the last class. I did not present a technical interpretation of intellectual conversion, but stressed rather simply the need for affective freedom. Coming to intellectual conversion. That is to say, the need for affective freedom in the pursuit of understanding and truth. As the person is affectively healed, the person becomes more spontaneously capable of intellectual conversion, of raising and answering the questions that lead to understanding the truth. Because the affective blocks that would prevent the person from raising those questions get dissolved as the person is healed with the gift of love. That's the emphasis that I was taking here. I'm not going to go into in this course a technical presentation of what constitutes intellectual conversion. For the full picture, that would be really important. Particularly, I'm convinced, important for our intellectual responsibilities today, intellectual responsibilities of the Church, to meet contemporary ideologies on the basis of intellectual conversion. That's not what we're dealing with explicitly here, so I'm not going to go into it much further. I referred you to such books as Newman's Grammar and Descent, Polanyi's Personal Knowledge, and Monica's Insight for treatments, technical treatments for intellectual conversion. But all we're concerned about here would be the following understanding of intellectual conversion. It is the release of the mind to pursue its native capacity to understand correctly. The release of the mind from all the blocks, the biases, so that it can pursue its native capacity to understand correctly. Now, well, I'm mainly concerned with those biases that are tied up with affectivity, the dramatic bias. Those obsessions, compulsions, fears, narrow desires, whatever they may happen to be, that affectively block the person from raising and answering certain questions. So from that standpoint, to come to intellectual conversion involves overcoming the fears and desires of the psyche, moving beyond the being healed of them, healed of those fears and desires that would make it impossible for me either to wait for the evidence before I pass judgment. Sometimes because of my fears and desires, I am so eager to pass judgment and get something sure that I don't wait on the evidence. So fears and desires can block the use of the mind in that way. I can jump from experience to judgment without passing through understanding because I'm tracked by my fears and desires. I can't wait upon evidence. But those fears and desires can have another and opposite kind of negative influence as well. That is to say, they may be so strong that even when the evidence is in, I find it incapable. I find myself incapable of judging, to judge when the evidence is in. But because of fears and desires, I can be either rash in my judgment or indecisive in my judgment. The affective healing overcomes those blocks in the pursuit of understanding the truth, rashness or indecisiveness, depending upon how those fears and desires are at work, inhibiting the normal process. Alright. Psychic conversion is a further movement in the process of healing. And as we dealt with it in the last class, and we'll be dealing with it further as the course goes along. Psychic conversion is the release of the repressive censorship that prevents images that I need from emerging into consciousness. It's the release of that repressive censorship that would prevent the images that I need ever emerging to consciousness. Or to put it positively, psychic conversion sets up a commerce or a communication between consciousness and the unconscious, so that the two are working together from the same base, along the same line, heading towards the same goal. They're not in conflict with one another because they get into communication with each other. They work together on the same base, along the same line, for the same goal. Again, I'm at it another way. A person may really desire insight into his or her difficulties, just to take ordinary psychic problems. A person may really desire the insight, but can be imaginatively organizing his or her experience in an incomplete way. My conscious organization of my experience, my self-image, my image of others, my image of the situations that I have to deal with, my image of where I've come from, my image of what my possibilities might be, those can be incomplete, partial, and to that extent distorted. And if I'm working with an incomplete, an inaccurate image, or set of images, of who I am and where I came from and where I could be going, then my self-understanding will be off base. That is, because images and insight are so closely connected with one another. You need appropriate images in order to have insight. Insight is into images. To the extent that the image that I'm dealing with, or a set of images, because there's really a lot of it, about myself, about my possibilities, about my problems, about the people in my life, situations, and so on and so forth. To the extent that those are leaving out some data that are relevant, to that extent my own insight is going to be incomplete and unsatisfactory in the long run. And if my insight is incomplete, so too my decisions in which I make myself who I am going to be suffer to that extent. So the whole question that we're dealing with in psychic conversion is, what am I leaving in the dark? We all leave something in the dark, and we have to.
Something like Ernest Becker and the denial of death makes it crystal clear.
We cannot be dealing with the totality of experience. We'd go crazy if we tried to. The question is, am I leaving relevant data in the dark? We all partialize our experience. As we organize it through images, we leave some things out. The question is, am I leaving out what needs to be included? Am I leaving out relevant data? Or am I responsible constitution of myself and my responsible participation with others in the making of the human world? We saw in the last class that Jung's insight at this point is very helpful, namely that the unconscious compensates. For the deficiencies of the conscious structuring of the world, the unconscious has a compensatory relationship to consciousness. So if I can get into touch with those images as they emerge, spontaneous expression, I can make up for the deficiencies in my conscious imaginative structuring of the world. The unconscious has a compensatory relationship to consciousness. It compensates for the deficiencies in the way in which the conscious ego has organized its world. So, for example, one of the things that dreams can do is to provide images left out by consciousness, left out in my waking experience, that compensate for the inadequate partialization of experience. Dreams make up what is lacking. Sufferings of the ego, there's some truth to that. They compensate for the ego's incomplete structure. Now, I want to say a little bit more than I did in the last class about that compensatory relationship, because it can take many different forms. At times it can be experienced as a very painful thing. In other words, there are experiences of dreams that quite explicitly correct one's conscious orientation. And they show you in the light, huh? They display at times the way in which you may be incompletely organizing. So that compensatory relationship at times can be directly experienced as a painful correction of the ego standpoint. Unfortunately, from one point of view, it doesn't always work that way. That's where the compensatory relationship can be clearest, when you have that kind of experience. Where, for instance, a person in his or her conscious life may be using another person for his or her own satisfaction and not admitting to oneself that that's what I'm doing. But the dream can show it quite explicitly, that there are motivations involved in my relationship to another person that are really seeking ego gratification in some way or another. And that can come across quite clearly as the dream structures the relationship. Okay. Now that can be a very painful experience to take a dream like that seriously.
painful correction of the conscious attitude. It's experienced as such emotionally. But as I say, unfortunately, that's not always the case. The dream can sometimes simply feel. I'm talking here about how dreams feel. Sometimes the dream can feel just as the ego, just as the waking ego feels. In other words, the feeling of the dream might not be felt as a painful correction, but it can seem to support the conscious attitude and seem to give energy for it. And at that point, you see, there's another insight of Jung's that is helpful here. The unconscious, yes, it compensates for the deficiencies of the ego by sometimes providing images that are not at hand for the ego, but sometimes it complements the ego's attitude. Its relationship to the conscious ego can be either compensatory or complementary. Sometimes it complements the ego's attitude and seems to support it. Now, what all of this is heading towards is that the ultimate responsibility does not lie with the dream. The ultimate responsibility lies with the waking subject interpreting the dream and deciding, particularly at this point, do I want to be this way? What kind of person do I want to be? The dream has got to be taken up into consciousness through all the creative levels, interpreted truthfully, and then particularly at that fourth level, the tough one.
Somebody said to me when I was teaching Lonergan, you know, be attentive, intelligent, reasonable is all right. Responsible, that's the bear. That's the fourth level.
Do I want that? Is that the kind of life I want to live? Is that the kind of way in which I want to structure my orientation in the world?
But the ultimate responsibility does not lie with the dream. I'm going to go into this in more detail later, related to my own. A lot about that, but you see that the dream can simply seem to support the conscious attitude, and the whole question is that what I want? So the dream's got to be taken up into consciousness and through all the levels. Responsible negotiation of it is the delegate. You don't just get in touch with it and leave it as it is. You have to decide whether that's the way you want it to be or not. Now, that complementary relationship of the dream to the attitude of waking consciousness can be quite positive. The dream can be showing something about your life that is worth supporting. The dream can be adding energy to a project that is really worthwhile and can be saying, speed ahead. But you, as existential subject, are left with the responsibility of deciding whether that's the case or not. You see what I'm saying? I just wanted to put that in to fill out what I said about the compensatory nature of the dream last time. Everything, you don't give up the process of the creative vector by getting in touch with the unconscious. It doesn't substitute. That contact has got to be filtered through the self-transcendent screen of the questions of human consciousness. So the role of questioning, the role of the creative vector remains decisive. Okay. All right, are there any questions on that? The rest of what we took in the last class, I'm not going to go into by way of review on that.
narrative and the complementarity of the two vectors.
Yes.
You mentioned the pain involved in surgery.
How much
pain, the pain of that realization, I deter it to affect back?
I would say it is relative, yeah. It can be a deterrent. The pain of the correction, is that what you're saying? The pain of the correction, yes. I think it's relative to the person and how the person is capable of dealing with the pain of truth, the painfulness of truth. David was telling us in one of the earliest classes, you know, about a dream that managed to correct a person's conscious orientation, that prior to that dream, the person was not able to deal with the pain of the correction, and that correction was suggested to him by others. The dream, however, enabled somehow the person to come into contact with the truth of the correction. But it can be a difficult experience. Yes?
You were saying earlier, too, that you're not supposed to push the interpretation of the dream.
Yes.
Well, that means you don't push it through those levels of consciousness that sort of has to experience level.
Yeah. Right. And particularly, it's that when you raise it to the level of interpretation, do not force the interpretation of the dream. To put it in a stark way here, I really basically distrust most dream books. What my dreams mean, or the meaning of dream symbols. And so you get this book, and you've got this automatic gold mine of resources to appeal to when a dream comes along. You know, some things, X always means Y. Well, it doesn't. A snake, for instance, doesn't always mean a phallus. Symbol. Sometimes a snake can be a snake. And it depends on you and what it's doing in your dream. And that's the kind of thing. You see, that can be a conceptualistic. Lonergan has the expression conceptualism. And by conceptualism, it means an attitude that does not allow the meaning to emerge out of the experience, but that has ready-made concepts that it dumps on experience, categories, before the experience can unveil its own. Conceptualistic mind is the mind that is wants to be so secure that it has a ready-made set of categories that immediately are dumped upon data to organize them. And that's what I'm trying to caution against.
So we don't really have any way of taking it to the
question. The inquiring mind, that's the only thing that is necessary for insight to emerge. The mind has to be it'll come when the mind emerges. Insight emerges. No, not necessarily complete and total insight all at once. But the mind that wants the insight will get it. But it frequently will get it at the moment when it might be taking a breather from the process of trying to force the interpretation. It's the same, I think it probably gave this already, but the same thing is true just of memory itself. If you're trying to remember a person's name and it's on the tip of your tongue, and as long as you force it, it just won't come. You relax in a half hour, like you're in the future. But you want it, and that's a very important condition of getting it, and wanting it. Same thing is true with insight. Archimedes' discovery of the laws of specific gravity. He wanted that insight, desperately wanted it, because his life was at stake. He came up with the answer, it came to have his head. You see. All right. He desperately wanted it, but it came to him in a moment when he was relaxing from it. But the whole orientation of his mind, his beautiful interaction, and it will come. Insight will come to require it. All right. Now, I'm treating number three here as being new material because I had such a short time to get into that in the last class that I really didn't give it at all the kind of treatment that I want to on dreams. Dreams are one major source of access to the compensatory or complementary images that are available to us in the psyche, from the quotes unconscious. The term has a bit of difficulty with it, but since we are so used to it, I will use it. Dreams are by no means the only access to those images. And a lot of people get upset because I talk so much about dreams, and they say that, you know, my dreams don't seem to be all that meaningful, or I don't have that many, or I can't remember them. Is there any other way into this? Well, there are many other ways. There are many other ways into the same thing. Ira Progoff has done a lot of excellent work at enabling people through other techniques to come into contact with those imaginal resources. Ira Progoff. One of the books that is very helpful is The Symbolic and the Real. It's one of Progoff's earlier books, The Symbolic and the Real, where he introduces a technique that he calls twilight imaging. And twilight imaging is a waking dream where you let yourself go, you let the images come, and you let them keep coming until they stop coming. And then do the same thing with those as we do when we filter them through the process, the creative process. All right, now, the one difference between twilight imaging and the dream is that it's extremely easy for the waking ego to interfere with the imaginal process. It's difficult for the waking ego to let itself be as free and as relaxed as the dreaming ego is, because the dreaming ego is asleep and it doesn't interfere. It can get in there and twist the images to its own purposes and its own gratification. Other such things that I mentioned in the last class, for instance, there are times when spontaneous songs can emerge in your mind. It can be very important. It can be a psyche's way of providing auditory images. Song is all of a sudden in your head. All right, okay. Glorify the Lord with me. Right there. He's saying something about where your psyche is at that time. There goes my reason for living. You might just be depressed. It could be worthwhile paying attention to. It might get you into contact with a depressive state that you might not have otherwise paid that much attention to. All right. Dreams I find valuable because, as Freud said, and Jung said even more clearly, when we're asleep, the repressive censorship is less in control. It's less in control over what will be permitted into consciousness. Your guard is down. If your guard were completely up, you wouldn't even be able to get to sleep. The guard is down, and the images are much less in danger of being manipulated by the contrivances of the... I think the question is still open between Freud and Jung, of how much danger there is that even in the dream the images can be manipulated. I think there's a lot more work that has to be done on that question. And I think the truth is somewhere in between what Freud and Jung said. Namely, Freud said that the dream is always something of a manipulation. And Jung said it never is something of a manipulation. And I would suggest that there's not the truth somewhere. I have a lot more work to do in working that out myself. I think an awful lot depends upon the authenticity of the subject, of the one who is sleeping. And is the person one who lets his or her guard down and who's willing to let things be? But there's no question that under any circumstances the guard is somewhat down in the sleep. But we're not able to. Venting that dimension from its exercise.
where's the, there's still a sensor there because we talked about the unconscious just bubbling up enough to be used. So where's the mechanism, conscious or unconscious?
I think the mechanism is in the relationship of the sensor to the desires of the waking subject. And that's why it's in between, and that's why I think the authenticity of the subject is the important deciding factor. In other words, do I want? Am I willing? Or...